Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
From VOA Learning English, this is As It Is. I'm Mario Ritter in Washington. Going to a college or a university in the United States can be expensive. On today's show, we will hear how some international students pay for their education in the U.S. Some have trouble paying for tuition, the cost of studying at school. They need to think of ways to fund their degrees, whether it is a graduate or undergraduate degree. Pete Musto brings us this story.
When Marine Hayashi first arrived at American University in 2013, she was a little afraid.
I got homesick, and I cried almost every day when I was in freshman year. And also, since English is my second language, I worked very hard.
Hayashi is originally from Hokkaido in the north of Japan. After 3 years at an international high school, she decided to attend a university in the U.S. Also, both of her parents earned graduate degrees from universities in the U.S. It was not long before Hayashi started enjoying her life as an international student. Joining three student groups helped her make friends from the U.S. and other countries. Hayashi will graduate in 2016 with a 4-year degree in communication studies. Her university experience is different from that of many young people around the world, though. Hayashi's parents are paying for all of her tuition. The cost of an undergraduate degree program as an international student at American University is $61,157 a year.
My parents said, like, do whatever you want, so they supported me, always.
The Hong Kong and Shanghai Banking Corporation, or HSBC, is an international banking company. The HSBC released a study in 2014 of the average university tuition and cost of living for international students. The study showed the average cost for international students in the U.S. is $36,564 a year. The Institute of International Education, or IIE, is an organization that studies and supports international student exchange. Together with the U.S. Department of State, IIE releases a report every year called Open Doors. Open Doors collects information about international students studying in the U.S. The 2015 Open Doors report shows 65% of funding for all international students comes from the students or their families. However, not all international students have enough money to pay full tuition. Many international students are finding other ways to pay the high cost. Some students avoid the cost completely.
And now we will take a short break. When we return, we will hear about how international students can afford to get advanced degrees in the U.S. Welcome back. You are listening to As It Is. Today, we are talking about ways that international students can attend a college or a university in the U.S. Knowing a few words will help you better understand the text of this report. To apply is to ask formally for something such as admission to a school or a job. Academic described something relating to schools and education. If something is complicated, it is hard to explain or deal with. And a hardship is something difficult to deal with or overcome in life. Now, let's return to Pete Musto as he continues with this story.
The 2015 Open Doors report shows that 21% of funding for international students comes from U.S. universities. This funding comes in the form of financial aid. Financial aid is money that is given or loaned to students to help pay for their education. Students usually ask for financial aid when they first apply to a university. Most universities decide which students receive financial aid based on students' academic history. Some U.S. universities are seeking to help international students in an active way, though. Brian Holzer is the International Admissions Counselor for the University of Wisconsin, River Falls. His job is finding students whom he believes will succeed at his school and help make it better. Many international students think that the admissions process is very complicated, but actually it is very simple and easy, Holzer told VOA. Many students have an interest in studying in the U.S., but may not know of everything available to them. So far, Holzer has traveled to almost 80 countries, including Brazil, Vietnam, Singapore, and Taiwan. During his travels, he visits high schools and university partners. He guides students through the process of how to apply to the University of Wisconsin River Falls. Holzer also explains how the university can help the students. The cost for international students at most U.S. universities is higher than it is for citizens. The yearly tuition at University of Wisconsin River Falls for international students is $22,000. This is the same tuition rate for students who are citizens from states other than Wisconsin. Also, international students immediately receive $2,000 a year in financial aid once the university accepts them. Students who perform well academically can receive up to $4,000 after their first year. The number of U.S. universities with international admissions counselors is growing. Holzer said the best part of his job is sharing his home with the world and bringing the world to his home. A few universities accept students for free, though. Five universities in the U.S. are considered need-blind for international students. A need-blind university is one that will accept a student even if the student does not have enough money to pay. These five need-blind universities are Amherst College, Harvard College, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Princeton University, and Yale University. In 2015, 37,307 students applied to study at Harvard. Harvard accepted only 2,081 students. Of new students, 12.2% are international students. Sally Donahue is the Griffin Director of Financial Aid and Senior Admissions Officer at Harvard College. She told VOA that almost 60% of Harvard students receive financial aid. How much money students receive depends completely on how much money they need. We meet the full demonstrated need of all accepted students, and all of our financial aid is based on need, she said. Families with incomes below $65,000 are not expected to give money. Studying in a country that is not your own can be difficult. Life can be lonely and the cost may be high. But Hayashi says that the experience is worth it.
So I went through a lot of hardships, like cultural differences or like homesick, but that made me strong. So yeah, I think it's worth it.
She said if she has children, she would like to send them to a university in the U.S. too. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Mario Ritter. Join us again tomorrow for another As It Is.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. What is the best way to catch someone who is telling a lie? For a long time, the traditional method of identifying liars was to watch their body language, including facial expressions. What if the person appears to be nervous? Is the person unable to look me in the eye? Is he or she looking around the room? What about other nervous movements, such as fidgeting or shifting from side to side? Many people, from parents to police officers and airport security personnel, depend on this method. But does a person's body and face reveal the truth? Not according to a new study. Talking, it seems, is the best way to smoke out a liar. That is what researchers in the United Kingdom found out recently. Their investigation took place at one place where lying can get you into big trouble, an airport. The researchers asked volunteers to pretend they were real passengers and then lie to airport security agents. Some of the agents used spoken conversation-based methods to question these make-believe passengers. Other agents depended instead on the person's body language, like lack of eye contact and showing signs of nervousness. The agents talking with the passengers were 20 times more likely to catch the liars. The study found that these conversation-based techniques can help you recognize when a person is lying to you. Like many methods, this conversation method has a name. It is called Controlled Cognitive Engagement, or CCE for short. Using body language and facial expressions to catch someone in a lie is really hard, and it only works, seemingly, by chance. Thomas Ormerod is the head of the School of Psychology at the University of Sussex in England. On the APA website, he reported that the suspicious signs method, or using body language, almost completely fails in finding lies. In the conversational CCE method, security agents just talk with passengers. They talk about informal things as you would in a normal conversation. While talking, the agents might ask questions about topics that are seemingly unrelated. Then the agent observes if the person becomes more evasive or erratic. They also observe if their way of speaking changes. In an article on the APA website, Ormerod says that for actual passengers, they are just chatting about themselves. It shouldn't feel like an interrogation. Here are four ways of catching a liar. Number one, use open-ended questions. These are the opposite of yes and no questions. Number two, use the element of surprise. Ask questions they may not think you are going to ask. Number three, look for small details that do not add up, or in other words, make sense. Number four, watch for changes in confidence and speaking styles. And that's the Health and Lifestyle Report. I'm Anna Mateo. You can trust me.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In 1864, the battle at Cold Harbor in Virginia ended a month of fighting by the Union Army of the Potomac. The campaign had brought the army almost to the edge of Richmond, the Confederate capital. But General Ulysses Grant had paid a terrible price, more than 50,000 Union dead and wounded. Confederate losses were much lighter, about 20,000. Grant was beginning to learn an important lesson of the war. The methods of defense had improved much more than the methods of attack. This week in our series, Harry Monroe and Kay Gallant continue the story of the American Civil War.
By the autumn of 1864, it appeared that the North would defeat the South in the war between the states. The Southern Army needed men and supplies. There was little hope of getting enough of either to win. The Northern Army was stronger and better equipped, but it too had suffered. Much of the death and destruction was the result of new military technology.
A new kind of bullet had been invented. It was called the mini-ball. It made the gun a much more deadly weapon. Before the mini-ball, few soldiers could hit a target more than 30 meters away. With the new bullet, they could hit targets more than 150 meters away. Soldiers with such weapons could be put into position behind stone or earth walls. Then it was almost impossible to defeat them.
Most American generals, however, seemed unable to accept this. They continued to use the old methods of attack that had worked before the mini-ball was invented. Hundreds or thousands of men were put in long lines across the front of the enemy position. A signal was given. The men began to march forward. When they got close, they fired their guns. Then they ran at the enemy and struck with their knives or hands. The idea was to shock the enemy, frighten him, and make him run away. As generals on both sides learned, this method no longer worked. The attackers were shot down before they could get close enough to hurt the defenders.
After 3.5 years of fighting, hundreds of thousands of Union and Confederate soldiers had been killed or wounded. Still, the war continued. In the East, Union armies were slowly pushing forward toward their main target. That was the Confederate capital at Richmond, Virginia. In the West, Union armies were slowly pushing deeper into Confederate territory. The Western armies were led by General William Sherman.
Sherman had two goals. One was to capture the city of Atlanta, Georgia. Atlanta was one of the few remaining industrial cities of the Confederacy. The other goal was to destroy the Confederate army led by General Joe Johnston. Sherman's army was stronger than Johnston's army, but the Confederates usually got into better defensive positions. Sherman refused to attack in such situations. It was easier to march around the Confederates and force them to withdraw. This happened again and again.
Confederate President Jefferson Davis began to believe that General Johnston was afraid to fight. He replaced him with another general. Within 2 days, that general attacked the Union Army. The attack began without enough planning. It was based on false information. It was a disaster. In 11 days of fighting, 1/3 of the Confederate Army in Georgia was destroyed. The remaining force was too weak to defend Atlanta. The city fell.
After capturing Atlanta, General Sherman fought a series of small battles with a Confederate force across northern Georgia. Then he decided to march to Savannah, a city on the Atlantic coast. Before leaving, his men set fire to the city. Almost all of Atlanta was destroyed. Sherman's army would continue to do this all the way to Savannah, Georgia, 350 kilometers away. It cut a path of destruction more than 100 kilometers wide. This campaign would be known as Sherman's March to the Sea.
Sherman said he wanted to make the people of Georgia suffer. He said he wanted to show the people of the Confederacy that their government could not protect them. Union soldiers stopped at every farm and village. They took food and clothing. They took horses, cows, and other farm animals. What they could not take or did not want, they destroyed. They set fire to houses and farm buildings. They burned crops. They destroyed stores and factories. They burned bridges and pulled up railroad tracks. Day by day, the Union Army of General William Sherman cut and burned its way across Georgia.
The army faced little opposition. Small groups of Confederate horse soldiers struck at the edges of the army, but they did little damage. On December 22, 1864, Sherman reached Savannah. He sent a message to President Abraham Lincoln in Washington. He said, "I beg to present you as a Christmas holiday gift, the city of Savannah." Sherman's campaign had cut a great wound in the heart of the Confederacy. All that remained were the states of South Carolina, North Carolina, and Virginia. His march to the sea had a great destructive effect on the spirit of the South.
Sherman's army rested in Savannah for a month. Then, on February 1st, 1865, it began to move north. The goal was to join General Ulysses Grant outside the Confederate capital at Richmond, Virginia. As Sherman's army moved across South Carolina, it destroyed almost everything in sight. The soldiers remembered that South Carolina had been the first state to rebel and leave the Union. They remembered that South Carolina had fired the first shots of the war. This time, against orders, they destroyed the land they left behind. Confederate forces could not stop them.
The same thing happened in the Shenandoah River Valley northwest of Richmond. In the early years of the war, Confederate forces had moved through the valley to strike northern territory. They had invaded Maryland and Pennsylvania and had threatened Washington from there. General Grant decided that the Confederates had used the Shenandoah Valley long enough. He sent some of his men into the valley. He ordered them to destroy everything that might be of use to the enemy. "Eat up, Virginia," he said, "clear and clean as far as you can go." Farms were burned. Crops were destroyed. Farm animals were taken away or killed. Nothing was left that could feed a man or animal. Nothing but blackened earth.
Then General Grant sent General Philip Sheridan into the Shenandoah Valley. Sheridan's army battled its way through the valley in the autumn of 1864. It gained victory after victory against a smaller, weaker Confederate force. By the end of the year, Union troops had complete control of the valley. The only Confederate power that remained was the army of General Robert E. Lee.
With the Shenandoah Valley closed to the Confederates, food supplies fell very low. There was almost nothing to feed the soldiers in Lee's army. Wagons would go out each day in search of food. They returned almost empty. More and more Confederate soldiers were running away. Some returned to their homes, others surrendered to Union forces. Confederate leaders no longer could find soldiers to take the places of those who left. Men would not answer the Army's call. There was, however, a huge labor force in the South that the Army had not called. Slaves.
Slaves had been used to do non-military work for the army. They had built roads and bridges. They had driven wagons. But they had not served as soldiers. In the North, thousands of free Negroes served in the Union Army, but they received less pay than white soldiers. Confederate lawmakers finally began to discuss the idea of using slaves as soldiers. A bill was proposed that would free any slave who joined the army to fight. Many Southern leaders opposed the bill, even if it would save the Confederacy. Said one, "Do not arm the slaves. The day you make them soldiers is the beginning of the end of the Revolution. If slaves make good soldiers, our whole idea of slavery is wrong."
General Robert E. Lee did not agree. He believed slaves could be made into good soldiers if they believed they had an interest in Confederate victory. He proposed giving immediate freedom to any slave who joined the army. The Confederate Congress passed a bill in March of 1865 to accept Negroes as soldiers. The bill did not promise to free them. By then, however, it was too late. An army of freed slaves could not be trained in time to save the Confederacy.
Our program was written by Frank Beardsley and Christine Johnson. The narrators were Harry Monroe and Kay Gallant. Transcripts, MP3s, and podcasts of our programs are online, along with historical images, at voaspecialenglish.com. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.